May it please the Court. Your Honors, the dispositive question is whether the DOC created a rule when it decided how the state of Missouri would carry out executions in the people's name. And appellant's contention in this case is that the act of choosing a method of execution is the making of public policy that needed to include the participation of the public under the Administrative Procedure Act. One underlying question that I need to spend some time on this morning is the Baugus test, which really wasn't an issue in the case until respondent's brief was filed last week. And on the merits
which test?
Of that,
what was it? Which,
the Baugus test, Your Honor. That is the case cited by respondents as well as the cases applying it. And if we articulate the test in that case, it becomes apparent that my clients satisfy it. And that is the question of whether something is a rule depends upon whether there is a potential, however slight, of impacting the substantive or procedural rights of some member of the public. And respondents argue that, well, this isn't a rule because that no prisoner has the right to choose his method of execution or to influence his method of execution, and the method that we've chosen doesn't violate the Eighth Amendment. But the question under Baugus and the cases that have applied it isn't whether an agency statement violates somebody's rights. It's whether an agency statement potentially affects somebody's rights.
What is the effect upon your client if this is promulgated as a rule? If the current statement that the Department of Corrections has
yes.
is promulgated as a rule,
yes.
what's the effect on your client?
Well, the effect upon my client...
I mean, is your client then precluded from challenging it once it's established as a rule because then it's law?
I'm not sure.
Administrative law?
He's saying if it was properly promulgated as a rule. Is that...
Yeah.
What benefit would that be to your client? Would your client presumably would want to put in evidence of why it's an inappropriate rule? Or, I mean, wouldn't your client be... you're suggesting it would somehow impact your client if it were adopted as a rule versus simply as an internal procedure.
Well, I'd have two responses to that. First of all, what I'm suggesting is that the choice of a method of execution impacts the rights of my client.
Right.
But aside from that, my client and others similarly situated, yes, would benefit if the Department of Corrections were to promulgate a rule because they could then participate in a public process of how is it should we execute
prisoners? No, okay. No, my question is, if it is a rule, if it's properly promulgated,
yes,
then it is beyond attack, isn't it?
If it has been properly promulgated as a rule, it is beyond attack under the APA.
Yeah.
That wouldn't necessarily immunize it from external substantive.
Now here, this rule has been attacked constitutionally through various other procedures.
Yes.
Okay. Now, is that available as well if it is a rule? I mean...
But what I would say, Your Honor, is that the availability or non-availability or success or failure of other substantive attacks really doesn't influence whether or not this is a rule. And in fact, whether or not this is a properly promulgated rule in turn doesn't really impact whether it independently violates the Constitution. And perhaps I'm not understanding your question.
He's saying if the state of Missouri adopts execution protocol properly through the rulemaking procedure,
yes.
what challenges are available and what are then not available?
Well, certainly there would be no challenges available that the agency failed to engage in notice and comment rulemaking under Chapter 536. I don't know. I can't see how the fact that the rule is adequately was properly promulgated, how that would extinguish or even affect any other kinds of attacks that might.
Well, let's say they promulgated a rule that said we're going to execute people by electrocution or hanging, and then there was public comment, and then they adopted the rule. You'd still have a right to challenge them as a cruel and unusual.
Absolutely. And likewise, if they had some obviously permissible method of execution that wasn't promulgated, it could still be challenged as not being promulgated.
Let me ask, are there two things going on here? One of the considerations is, does whatever the procedure adopted by the Department of Corrections meet constitutional requirements? And that is subject to being attacked in many different ways.
Yes, and I don't think that's...
That's not what's in front of us here.
No.
The second question is the more the political question, what policies ought to be considered in determining the manner in which the state would carry out executions. And what you're saying is you have more of a right to participate in that if it is a rule that is public and hearing comment than if it is just something the department can state without that type of hearing.
Right. And so if this formulation meets the definition of a rule, that is an agency statement of general applicability that interprets, implements, or prescribes law or policy, in that instance...
And what I was getting to then is once that's been determined, rules have certain status beyond mere agency statements or declarations. It is more solid as law.
Yes, they carry the force
and,
of
and,
law.
And that would be somewhat contrary to your client's interest, and I was wondering how. Or you don't even want to worry about that. You just want another 6 months to have a rule and to have an argument about it.
It seems to me that, yes, there might be a certain prestige that is offered.
Well,
it
has more legal aura. As
yeah, and I don't think, Your Honor, that legal aura trumps constitutional rights.
I'm not saying it does. I'm asking, what is there a downside?
No, I don't believe there is a downside, Your Honor. Certainly not any sort of downside that outweighs the ability to come and inform this agency as to how else it might execute people and how it perhaps might want to avoid methods that aren't legal to use for euthanizing animals.
But by opening it up to the public, organizations like Lancet or the AMA or other kinds of expertise could be brought to bear. At least you don't even know what the public comment might be, but yet that could be submitted. There would be no restrictions on who could submit comments to the rule.
Well, there can be no restrictions. In fact, Section 536.021 requires the agency to notify the public in the register that anyone is free to come and comment at a certain time and in a certain way, and they can hold hearings. So without question, yes, that sort of evidence would be brought to bear. And whether those sorts of medical problems create a constitutional problem or not with inflicting this means of punishment, it may influence reasonable people to go about devising and implementing a more humane way to carry out executions. And I didn't mean to...
No, I just was going to address the second issue, which is if we were to find it was a rule because it was a statement of general applicability to how executions are carried out, opposing counsel, the state still argues that it's not that it falls within the exception to the requirement that it issue this procedure by rule. So can you address that more specifically?
Sure. And there are two such exceptions at issue. One is whether the rule is a statement concerning only the internal management of the DOC. And there are actually multiple reasons why that particular exception doesn't apply, and those are addressed in our brief. But the most straightforward is that this rule does not speak solely to people who are inside the agency, as a statement, as something must under the internal management exception. Most of the provisions of this protocol are directed to outside medical practitioners, and it is they who implement most of the steps that are specified.
Aren't they employed by the Department of Corrections?
They are not employed by the Department of Corrections. Opposing counsel argues, well, they have contracts with the Department of Corrections. But that certainly doesn't bring them within the agency in any sense of law that I can think of. Now, I know we spent a lot of time this morning talking about who's affiliated with whom. So I don't know that I want to belabor the point. But I think the clearest demonstration that somebody who contracts with the agency isn't part of the DOC is the DOC's own program that is promulgated to bring in outside employers to lease land and facilities within the DOC and to hire inmates as employees. They promulgated a rule to do that. And we know that program isn't just about internal agency management, and we know those companies aren't part of the DOC. Even though they have a continuous physical and ongoing presence, they are certainly much more arguably part of the DOC than is some doctor who lives in another state and who comes to Missouri once or twice a year to help carry out an execution.
Why shouldn't we follow the decision in the Tennessee court?
There are a couple of reasons. The first is that there really is a very substantial difference between Missouri's exemption for statements concerning inmates and Tennessee's exemption for statements concerning only inmates. Now, I know it's just one word, but it is a word with great importance in this context. And the reason is this. If we just step back and think about what does the Department of Corrections do, it manages and it oversees prisoners. I've been thinking, and I cannot think of a binding directive that would be issued by a DOC that does not concern inmates. They necessarily do. So if the exception is for statements concerning inmates, the implication is that the DOC is absolved from all rulemaking responsibility under the APA, which happens to be the law in Tennessee, and that is not the law in Missouri. Section 217.040, which is in our appendix, expressly provides that the DOC may, and in some circumstances must, in other words, when its directives otherwise meet the statutory language of a rule, promulgate a rule through Chapter 536 and also submit it to JCAR for review. The legislature would never have said that in its statute in 1994 if in 1976 what it really meant is, well, we really just want an exemption for inmates and not
for
statements
that are
about
only people who are on parole. They're not inmates.
Well, I suppose. In which case, the statute might have said something about parole. But I still think it's exceedingly unlikely that that the legislature intends...
kind of going along with your argument, aren't the two words we're really concerned with, both here and they're concerned with there and in internal management, is concerning only? Those are the two operative rule words that we're worried about. And then the subject of internal management and then the subject of inmates.
Yes, the phrase concerning only is very important in both contexts. And I've never meant concerning in the sense of, oh, this causes me great anxiety. I simply mean concerning in the sense of what it is that the directive expressly talks about. In other words, is it talking about inmates? Is it talking about staff? Who it is expressly directed to? And who does it inevitably and directly affect? And that says something, a statement concerns those entities. But I see my time is up.
May it please the court, I'm Mike Spillane. I represent the Department of Corrections and its director, and I would ask that the decision of the Circuit Court of Cole County be affirmed. I want to mention something that was mentioned by the plaintiff before I forget. The Baugus case, if one looks at page 42, it refers to substantial impact. I don't think I pointed that out very strongly in the brief, but in the initial thing where it talks about a chance of a possibility of impact, it talks about impact, and then in the last paragraph, it said no substantial impact on the parties.
Well, what is about this quote that says, agency declaration has a potential impact, however slight, of impacting the substantive or procedural right?
Exactly right.
And so it's however slight, not substantial impact.
Well, however slight, the slight
impact on substance or procedure.
Slight modifies the chance of impact. The probability, however slight. And then if one reads down to the end, the actual holding, it says there was no substantial impact on any of the parties. So I just thought I wanted to point that out because they use both words.
What about how do you distinguish this case from the Maryland case?
Now, the Maryland case has two distinctions. One, there is no exception relevant to our exception K in Maryland. And another distinction is
I'm sorry, what's the distinction?
Exclusion, K, concerning only inmates, okay, does not exist in Maryland law. They have an internal management exception, but not a concerning only inmates. And that's the distinction the trial court made.
Are you giving up on the...
No. Okay. No, I was just going to say that there are two reasons. That's what the trial court focused on as well. But I think their internal management analysis, the trial court also mentioned, and I think is correct, that there was no substantial right pointed out by the Maryland court. The way I know the other side disagrees with me on this, but I thought the Maryland analysis was we decide what the legislature is concerned by, and then that's rulemaking.
But can you say to me that how you execute someone, whether you execute someone, the procedure you use is not of general interest, is not of public interest? I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court has just taken a case on this. It's subject to great interest and scholarly review all over the country, and you're saying, it's just internal management of the Department of Corrections, nothing else. That seems counterintuitive.
I do not believe that there cannot be internal management procedures that are of public interest. So I do not think they are mutually exclusive. Of course, capital punishment and executions concern people, but that isn't the meaning of concern in the statute.
Well, if you adopted something saying, you know, let's poke them 50 times before and use the 50th poke to administer the point. I mean, there's lots of things you could do that are of public interest. And it's not simply when do you form the line to go to the, you know, to get food from, to get some snacks from the store, or when do we close the doors at the cells, things that would affect internal management of the prison. It has to do with, doesn't an execution protocol inherently involve much more than simply procedures within the prison walls?
I believe not. And I think what you just said was procedures within the prison walls. This is a procedure within the prison walls. There are medical contractors involved as well as at-will employees, just as there are contractors involved, I suppose, in setting up CaseNet. But that doesn't make it a rulemaking procedure. It's still the question is the procedure itself internal management? This is.
And so you could let contracts, for instance, without, I mean, what are the implications of that? Because there are many, many contracts that the prison has with
Certainly.
Outside entities, and you're saying none of them are subject to rulemaking.
And I think none of them are subject
authority.
To rulemaking now. I think all of the medical care is done by CMS now, if I'm not mistaken. And if one looks at the CF, mm-hmm. The Code of State Regulations, there's very little in there that's rules. There are books of SOPs about prison management. None of that has ever been considered under Missouri law to be something that's subject to rulemaking. This is kind of a new thing. I think they've picked out one thing with employers coming in and hiring inmates, and I can understand that. That's kind of an odd thing, but that's on the other side of the divide.
I'm sorry, how is that different from this?
This is completely internal management. We're not hiring people to raise cattle or something.
But you are contracting with outside
Yes.
independent contractors to
right.
come
if
in.
Right, if we contracted for a guard or someone mm-hmm. to fix a toothache, that wouldn't require rulemaking either. I mean, this is an important high issue, and I don't mean to trivialize it, but the principles are the same. And there's something I almost forgot that I want to get to before I... 217.040.2. They talked about the rulemaking authority under 217.040. But if one looks at the second paragraph of that statute they cited, it talks about internal management policies and procedures don't have to be rules. So there are two reasons why that doesn't hurt us. One, if something doesn't fit within the definition of rule, then under 217.040.1, we don't have to promulgate it as a rule. You read the statutes together. And two, under 217.040.2, it talks about internal management doesn't have to go into the Code of State Regulations or the State Register, which is it doesn't have to be promulgated as a rule. And that doesn't even have a substantive impact.
But it's open and available to the public.
Yes, it has to be available to the public, as this is.
Shouldn't we be construing these exceptions more narrowly? I mean, this is more than a housekeeping function, and it's more than just a personnel matter. How do you address the narrow construction that we're required to give?
Well, first of all, I would say the concerning only inmates exception, this is asking the Department of Corrections and employees and their contractors who are carrying out a function that could be carried out by employees to carry out an action essentially carrying out the punishment of inmates. As far as I can tell, that's completely internal. I mean, did you have a question with that?
For carrying out the punishment of inmates, this is not something that you get to choose to do. This is a sentence.
Exactly right. They're carrying out the sentence of inmates. So when I say the word punishment, the sentence might be a more correct word, but they're carrying out the sentence of inmates just as if they were confining them for life in prison.
So this is a housekeeping measure in your view?
Not a housekeeping measure. I don't want to trivialize it, but it is an internal management measure.
You know, there's a distinction that, and I don't know whether it means something for this case, but when an inmate is brought to an institution on a term of years or even for a life sentence or even life without parole, that's his punishment.
Yes. And
that's why he's there to be punished. The inmate who's brought there on a sentence of death, however, is there awaiting his punishment. Now, I don't know whether that is a distinction without a difference in terms of this, but this really does have to do with the manner in which the court's ordered punishment is carried out. And I'm not sure whether that raises to a level of importance than, say, a disciplinary rule or a regimen of treatment or whatever within the institution for people who are being punished while there.
I do not believe.
You see my distinction?
I do not. I see your distinction, but I think both are carrying out a lawful sentence. I mean, obviously, the prison is going to have walls. There's going to be a certain amount of space in the cells and so forth, and that's important, and people should be concerned about it, and it has a potential impact on constitutional rights, but it's still an internal management matter, and it's still concerning only inmates.
No, but that doesn't address the point I think Judge Wolf made, that it's really the sentence of death that is imposed by the court. It's not an internal procedure. It's different in kind. They're simply being kept safe sort of in the prison awaiting the sentence of the court.
Well, yeah, I think
that's unique.
I understand the argument, but I think that how one carries out, for instance, a life sentence is not governed by regulation, and how one carries out a death sentence, which this is, it's implementing the statute, just as implementing the statute that someone be imprisoned for life is being carried out. I'm not sure I'm satisfying your concern there, but it seems to me to be the same thing.
Well, for instance, this court has to sign a death warrant. We don't sign a warrant to go to administrative segregation or something else because it doesn't occur without a further order of this court, because its death is unique and it's being carried out pursuant to the court's sentence and pursuant to this court's
and
warrant.
And because the statute requires it.
Right, right, exactly.
And something else I don't want to forget about things. When I was looking over the statute, 5336-1010C, this isn't something that the trial court relied on, but it also seems to be important, and I feel a duty to point it out. It's like A, but that's the exclusion for intra-agency memorandum, directives, or other communications that don't have a substantial, well, I'm sure the court's familiar with it, that don't have a substantial impact on the public substantive or procedural rights. And I think the court has to think about that as well, although the circuit court didn't rely on it. On reflection, I think that's important because that takes the agency argument out of it and takes us into substantial impact argument. Just like 217.040.2 takes the substantive impact out of it and just says, is it an agency? So those are things that the circuit court didn't think about, but I think are important for the court to think about. And you may have questions about that, because I kind of blurted that out a little bit.
Other courts have adopted criteria of what constitutes an agency statement, whether or not it constitutes a rule. Could Missouri benefit by more criteria? Outlining and some factors adopted on what constitutes a rule?
Well, I think that what constitutes a rule under Missouri law is defined by the legislature at 536.010.
Is it clear enough as it is now?
Yes. It's standard. It's language out of the Model Administrative Procedure Act as it was modified in 1981, I believe. May not be. I can't swear that it's exactly the same, but that's the source of it. And I think that's what everybody's working from. And exceptions A and K are out of the same model act. So, I mean, I'm not sure we need more legislative clarification. I think it's there. There's a dearth of case law because I don't think anybody has ever thought these things were rules, so there aren't cases about it.
For more criteria from the courts interpreting the statutory language.
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, Idaho has like a six-factor test in trying to make this determination
that's
their
right.
Courts came up with.
And I think that's analogous to Balgus and Missouri Soybean and Labundy, what this court has done. This court has done that by judicial interpretation and has said that if all we look at is general applicability, then everything's a rule. That clearly isn't the case.
Well, everything's certainly not a rule. Statements of general applicability are very different. I mean, there's many things that are case-specific that are individual specific. You're not talking about, though, you didn't adopt a set procedure for this person. You have a statement of general applicability. This is how we execute people in Missouri. And this protocol is always followed.
I guess I didn't answer the question very articulately. What this court in Balgus was doing was not saying everything is a rule, but saying that every statement of general applicability would be a rule, if I understand Balgus correctly. And that isn't necessarily so. Therefore, we put on these other criteria about impact on substantive
but
procedural
rights. But the
statute
says every statement of general applicability is a rule unless an exception applies, and as has been pointed out, exceptions apply are construed narrowly. And it A says a statement concerning only the internal management of an agency and which does not substantially affect the legal rights or procedures to the public.
Exactly,
you have to
right.
prove both. So if we find this is not a matter concerning only the internal management of an agency, then the exception does not apply.
Then you move to C, Your Honor.
Okay.
What meaning would you have us give to the words concerning only? Concerning seems to be a rather broad.
Concerning is rather broad, and I think they got it inadvertently a little backwards in the statute. It's Tennessee that says concerning and Missouri that mm-hmm. says concerning only. I'm sure the court caught that. And I think concerning only, if you read it to mean it has no potential impact on anybody but an inmate, I can't think of a rule that would fit within concerning only. I think they came up in their brief with mealtimes. And I think that's the best they could do, and I'm not even sure that would fit within their
definition. Well, there'd have to be contracted employees.
Exactly, because the cooks would be impacted.
By the food.
So concerning only doesn't mean it touches, it has no impact, possibility of touching anybody. And I
but how do you argue that that should be narrowed then?
Well, I think we get guidance. I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand your question.
Okay, if concerning only is something narrower than any possible concern.
Yes.
How do you narrow it?
I think the focus of the rule is on inmates. Now, I think a good example they came up with was their Wilkinson case out of Arizona, which I read as giving the warden the authority to determine who was a clergyman for coming in and talking to inmates. And maybe I misread the case, but that's kind of the way I read it. And that has a direct impact on First Amendment rights outside the prison.
Well,
so, I mean, go ahead, please, John.
Doesn't this have any impact on the doctors? You say a contract out for the doctors. Wouldn't it have an impact on a doctor's being contracted to perform the...
Certainly it has an impact on the doctors, just as any rule we had about medical treatment would have an impact on doctors, just as anything about menus would have an impact on cooks. But I'm saying, concerning only, the focus of it has to be the inmate. I mean, go ahead, Your Honor, I see you're in trouble again.
No, go right ahead.
What I was talking about is the distinction with K before. I think that teaches that concerning only doesn't have the narrow meaning they talk about. A is the internal management exception. It says only internal management, concerning only internal management, and it says affecting substantial effect on substantive and procedural rights. So A tells us that there can be such an animal that is only internal management but affects substantive and procedural rights of someone else. And I think we read K as part of the same statute with A and say concerning only in A means the same as K, and concerning, my light's on.
You finish your sentence.
I say the analysis of K is guided by A.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal?
A few words concerning only. But not concerning, only concerning. opposing counsel is correct. There is no rule out there that concerns only inmates, because inmates don't live in a vacuum. They have guards who are around them each and every day. So even the designation that we're going to have chicken fried steak today affects people who aren't inmates. And that's not the rule of law that we are pursuing. The rule that has been recognized both by the court in Arizona and the Supreme Court of Iowa and by the author of the model legislation is that the concerning only inmates exception will not apply if the statement relates to or affects somebody outside of the prison system. And so that's why the court in Arizona said that a prison's restriction on inmates from clergy affect inmates and clergy, so obviously the statement does not concern only inmates.
Well, and also, you're limited. I mean, it doesn't deal with daily menus because it's not a statement of general applicability. So
exactly.
You don't reach the original premise of
and
what is the
rule. And just as it is with daily menus, so it is also with fixing a guard's toothache, to use another example. Those aren't statements of general applicability, and so the whole framework doesn't really apply.
Now, the method of execution by lethal injection is established by statute, true?
What is established by statute is that the state may use lethal injection or lethal gas.
Okay.
Within those parameters, what the department has done is to select a certain set of mechanisms and policies that are permissible under the statute and elected not to go with others. And that is quintessentially an administrative lawmaking function. That's the kind of things, that is the sort of thing that agencies do when making legislative rules that we require them to promulgate them through the
and
APA.
Statutes direct who can be present to witness the execution. Is that true, too?
No. The statute does not itself speak to witnesses, I don't believe, Your Honor. Nevertheless, we do believe that witnesses are an inherent part of the process. They are always allowed. We always have witnesses. Very often we have witnesses in favor of the execution in question, invariably some against the execution in question, and they are there to lend some legitimacy to the process. So to the extent that that the court doesn't agree that this protocol affects people beyond inmates because it affects the doctors, because maybe you don't buy the maybe you agree with the state that that a contract makes them part of the agency, but we still argue that they that the method of execution necessarily affects those who are there to witness the execution, and the type of method that is chosen certainly informs the type of death that will be witnessed.
This protocol is entitled Preparation and Injection of Chemicals.
That's correct. I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is submitted.